And now, get ready, folks. It's time for Banter with Bob Sherwood and Dan Snell. Banter.
Podcast audio listeners can find this video on YouTube. Search Banter with Bob and Dan.
And now, here's Bob and Dan.
Hey guys and gals, it's Saturday morning and I got up early today. I set my clock for 8:30, got my coffee. I'm down now because the Banter program is expanding. If you've been listening to us lately, you realize we now have three segments. We have the Banter segment. That's where Dan and I debate political or non-political issues. We banter back and forth.
Yes,
that's
great one banter segment. There, great banter.
The second segment is where we deal with special topics and follow them over time. Topic that's has of national interest and maybe one that has some educational benefit. The third segment that we have, and you may have seen this if you've watched, it was on yesterday, we interview what we call conversations with interesting people. And yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, was it Dan, or the day before yesterday, we had a conversation with a 14-year-old prodigy and an 8-year-old prodigy who have already played Carnegie Hall, Royal Albert Hall, orchestras really around the world.
Incredible.
Okay, now, but today, and we're going to have more conversations. And by the way, if you're listening, if you think you know an interesting person, and some of you do, email us. We'll reach out to them. But they have to be interesting. Now, today, we're doing a special segment. It's a special segment on something that you're reading about probably every day, but not thought much about. And I'm going to give you some thoughtful observations. Dan's going to ask me questions, and I'm going to start following this all the time. So we'll do segments on it from time to time. It is the Brian Kohberger trial.
Which, in other words, is the Idaho college student murders.
Right. Now, it's fascinating, and I'll tell you right now, it's going to be bigger than the O.J. Simpson trial. Much bigger. It's going to last longer. There'll be a lot more publicity once it gets going. A couple of things that you may not know that just recently, for example, well, let me go back. They haven't given us the names, by the way, of the survivors. They use initials. They use like GM or MT. Those are survivors. So one of the survivors was interviewed. I didn't know this. Interviewed, I guess, by the prosecution.
Like a grand jury or
was,
just the prosecution privately or the grand jury?
No. There's no grand jury involved here, right? Okay. Grand jury is way, way back. Remember, this has been going on for 2.5 years. November yes. of 2023, or 2022 is when this started, right? We're now in 2025. Now, so they interviewed one of the survivors. Now, and by the way, there's two big timelines. There's a timeline that Fox News puts out, and there's a timeline that I think it's NBC puts out, maybe CNN. They're a little bit different, but there's some similarities. I'll go over those. But listen to what the survivor says. The survivor, one of the survivors, remember there's two survivors, four people were murdered, three girls and one guy. And by the way, if you follow this, you'll notice they always show the same pictures. With all due respect, these girls were what a lot of guys would say were hot. I mean, they looked very cute in these pictures, right? So I don't know what they were all up to. I'm just making that point because it wasn't, you know, they looked like they were like all cheerleaders. Okay, now, so the survivor, one of the survivors, in fact, maybe I can, let me see if I can switch gears just for a second. And, okay, now I'm going to read some of this from something I've downloaded, but a roommate inside the home where the four University of Idaho students were killed saw one of her housemates on the floor minutes after seeing a masked intruder, but walked past the scene, according to a new court filing. Now, I want to focus right on that. First, remember the house has three floors. The four people that were murdered were on the second and third floor, and the two people that survived were on the first floor. Now, we don't have good pictures of the house now because they tore it down. So we really don't know how the house was configured. But
they tore it down?
Yeah. But guess what? They've hired a person who's rebuilding the whole house in a small three-dimensional way so people they can use it at trial, right? They should have kept the house so we'd actually see how far the bedrooms were apart.
Well, yeah, it's a crime scene. That's interesting. It's a crime scene. How can you destroy a crime scene?
Well, they were not supposed to, but they went ahead and did it. They were being the university right now.
Oh, this is intrigue. This adds to the intrigue.
But let me read this again, slower. A roommate inside the home where four University of Idaho students were killed saw one of her housemates on the floor minutes after seeing a masked intruder, but walked past the scene, according to a new court filing. Now, think about it. First place, the survivors are on the first floor. The people that are killed are on the second or third floors. Now, she apparently, this occurred according to the timeline, what I just read, about 4 a.m. Now, remember, and this is an amazing thing, the medical examiner who did the analysis concluded that the deaths occurred between 4 a.m. and 4:21 a.m. How they did that, I don't know. I'm not a medical examiner. But so when we're talking about what happened at the house, we need to focus on what happened in that, let's say, 20 or 25 minute period. So during that period, according to one of the survivors, apparently walked past her roommate. Now, what does that mean? If the survivor was on the first floor, did she go up to the second floor and walk past her bedroom and happen to see her on the floor? Now, if you saw your good friend on the floor, what would you do? You'd probably go try to wake her up. Apparently, she didn't do anything. On top of that, remember,
well, that's a question, is sometimes you get that many people living in a house, and this was November, so maybe they just started in the semester. Maybe they weren't great friends. Maybe they were just...
No, they were all good friends.
Okay.
Yeah, they talk about that as being the background. In fact, two of them worked together. You know, they were just at all a big party together, you know, just earlier that night. No, so they're friends. But the point is, if you saw a masked intruder and then saw one of your roommates on the floor, what would you do? You'd probably go see if she's okay. Well, this person didn't. And remember one more thing. The forensic guy who did one of the analyses, and I'll go through that, they've had already two forensic people involved. One of the forensic people said there's blood all over the scene. So if your friend is on the floor and had just been stabbed to death, there'd be blood everywhere. You wouldn't see it, I guess, according to the survivor who filed this report. No, the survivor didn't see any blood, at least not in the report. The survivor didn't even go over and ask her friend what was going on. Now, let me keep going a bit, right?
Keep going.
It's kind of interesting. Now, think about the questions I'm raising. How did the roommate, which they called DM in the report, now they haven't given us her full name, at 4 a.m., supposedly when the murder started happening, DM reported hearing strange noises as well as crying coming from the bathroom. According to the document, she opened the door and saw a man dressed in black with a ski mask on. First place, which door should she open? The bathroom door? And what bathroom was she talking about? The survivors were on the bottom floor. You see the problem here? She heard noises coming from a bathroom, and she didn't go check them out. She sees a guy with a ski mask. She hears noises from a bathroom. Which bathroom? We don't know. The bathroom on the second floor, bathroom on the third floor. And if there were noises coming from the bathroom, then they weren't dead yet. They were still alive. So what did she do? Did she check out the bathroom? No, she didn't do anything, right?
Did she just go to bed, go downstairs, go to sleep?
This is what I'm driving at.
Well, do you think, is it possible if they went out party that they were so drunk that they were just kind of staggering in their brain and they're trying to respond to these?
One of the survivors, that was what she said. I thought she was just drunk. Well, okay, again, but how does that not conflict with the thought that there was blood everywhere and she didn't see any of the blood?
Well, I mean, if it was dark, it's possible she wouldn't notice the blood because maybe the girl had on.
I don't know. These are all, you're raising all good questions. Those are all what I'll call hypotheticals. What I'm really driving at is that none of the information that we're talking about that seems critical has been raised yet. Like, what bathroom? You saw the person on the floor, but it was so dark you couldn't see blood. Now, in the court filings, they don't say it was dark. Doesn't say it was dark and she couldn't see. It was light enough that she could see somebody on the floor, right?
Yeah,
and
that would be a question you'd think that the prosecution or the detectives would ask. Was the room, was the light, was it a well-lit, you know, room, or was it dark?
Yeah.
Or?
Well, on top of that, if she noticed that the person on the floor, one of the people that were killed, this is at 4 o'clock in the morning, 4 a.m., she noticed that the feet were pointing to the wall and the head were pointing in another direction. In other words, it was light enough that she could see the direction that her friend was laying, where her feet were and where her head. So it was a little bit light, right?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, there's so many issues here right now. Now, we'll call the one person DM and the other BF. Those are the survivors. I don't know their name. That's what they're usually called in reports, DM and BF. So what happened? After seeing the man with the ski mask on, DM called and texted her roommates, didn't say which roommates, to see if they were awake. BF was the only one to respond. So in other words, after seeing this guy, this person on the floor, she texted her roommate, BF. Now, again, we don't know if they're in the same room. They're in different bedrooms. Remember, according to the layout of the house, each floor had two bedrooms. Were these people in the individual bedrooms? I don't know. Doesn't say. We haven't got that information yet. But listen. So she says she called and texted her roommates. Called them and texted them, right? That's what it says. That's what she testified to. And the only one that responded was her other survivor, BF. And she called him twice. One phone call lasted 24 seconds. The second phone call lasted 41 seconds. And it happened just 1 minute after the first call. And DM said, hey, I saw a man in a ski mask leaving the house. So that's what she told a BF. Now, at this point, we know DM was somewhat concerned, right? She called and texted her roommates, texted BF, but she didn't do anything yet. Now, here's the other point. The two they're talking about are the survivors. So let me read it that way. The survivors would continue frantically texting each other 4:22 a.m. to 4:26 a.m. So there's at least 20 minutes when they didn't do anything. Now, if they were frantically, I don't know if that's a quote from the court document or not, but frantically means that they thought something was wrong. They didn't go check on any of the other people in the building. All she says, all DM said, DM texts BF and say, hey, no one's answering. And BF texted back, and I guess this is probably a quote. It says, yeah, dude, WTF, BF responded. Xana was wearing all black. I think that's the correct one. It's probably, it's X-A-N-A, so that could be Chana if it's Chinese, right? But here's the point. So the two people that were surviving, DM and BF, they're texting each other. Nobody else is responding. BF is saying, hey, I think who you saw was Xana, X-A-N-A, because she was wearing all black. Now,
oh, so they mistook.
Well, we don't know what they did.
BF, why would you wear a mask? I guess you'd wear a mask in the house. I guess if they had
well, yeah, but listen, here's the point. BF is really discrediting what DM saw. He's saying, I don't think, now, I'm not quoting, I'm paraphrasing. He's saying, I don't think you saw a masked person. I think you saw Xana because she was wearing all black. But they didn't go down and check. So the survivors are texting each other. They're not getting responses from the other four people, but they don't do anything.
But both the survivors were on the first floor.
Well,
or are they in different bedrooms?
We don't know. In other words, here's what we know factually. There was a first floor. There was two bedrooms in the first floor. We don't know if they were in the same room together, BF and DM, or not.
Okay.
We don't know where the bathroom was that she checked out, where that she heard the crying from. So here we got, so now we've got about 4:26 a.m. DM then left her room. And this is, you have to really listen to this, all right? Listen to this carefully.
Okay.
DM then left her room and began running toward BF's room. That's the other survivor. And saw Kernoodle, that's one of the murdered girls, laying on the floor of her bedroom with her head towards the wall and her feet toward the door. That was at 4:17 a.m. How do they know that exactly? I don't know, right? But that's what the details are now, the timeline, right? So she saw somebody laying on the floor at 4:17 a.m. Now, as you pointed out, at that time, DM thought Kernoodle was drunk. Okay, but she didn't do anything. In fact, when did she finally do something, survivors? 8 hours later. So after all this frantic texting and calling and seeing somebody on the floor, she didn't do anything about it. And as you point out, which is a great question, what floor was DM on when she saw Kernoodle on the floor? Did DM go up to the other floors? I don't know.
That isn't asked by the detectives or the prosecutors.
Well, I haven't got a hold of the full transcript, and I don't know if I'll be able to. So I'm looking at a summary of the transcript. Now, this is the timeline, by the way. And you remember what I just said a minute ago, because I want to make sure we keep that in mind. So at 4:17, according to the court filing, she saw Kernoodle on the floor. 4:17. She never did anything. She didn't check Kernoodle and never called 911 or did anything until about noon, about 8 hours later. 8 hours. Now.
Because they were just asleep. I mean, kids that age, they do sleep until noon.
Well, no, but is that the point? I mean, that's a good question. That's certainly a logical question, right? But if I was frantically texting my other roommate, BM or DM or BT, so I was frantically doing something because I was worried, and I saw her, she was on the floor. Why wouldn't I go check it out if she was drunk or not? I would do that.
Well, as an adult, but sometimes you don't know if college students would just go, she's.
Well, that's what the prosecution will say. This is just what kids do. But to me, it doesn't make sense. I'm not arguing for the prosecution. I'm not arguing for the defense. What I'm really just stating is what are the facts that they're uncovering and what are the missing gaps? Now, Fox News interviewed a detective. And the detective apparently went up to, the change of venue. It's now in Boise, Idaho, 300 miles from Moscow where the murders took place. So the detective goes up to Boise and interviews the prosecutor. Now, prosecution, I don't know if he interviewed the defense. He never said it. But he said, I've interviewed the prosecution and they've got a solid case. So he was asked, well, what's a solid case based on? And here's what this detective said. It's based on the fact that they have evidence that he purchased a knife from Amazon. Remember, let me make sure he has evidence they purchased a knife.
And they found the sheath from that knife.
Oh, let me finish. No,
okay.
You're just concluding something. There's no evidence that he bought a sheath. The evidence is that he bought the knife. They've always very carefully said, we have evidence that he bought a knife. Right now. So that's one point. Now, the next point, the guy said, hey, and they found a sheath with his DNA on it in the bed of one of the victims. Now, there's all kinds of ways that sheath could have got there. And also, by the way, we got to assume that there may be DNA everywhere in this room of other people. But factually speaking, going back to what the detective said, hey, we have evidence he bought a knife. A sheath with his DNA on it, which, by the way, is subject to issue yet, how they got the DNA, was found in the victim's bedroom. Then third one is they have evidence, well, they have visual evidence of some type that there was a white car in the neighborhood. And sure enough, Kohlberger drives a white car. So that's not conclusive for sure, right? I was probably
yeah,
100,000.
White there. I think the color white is like, I think I read somewhere that 78% of Americans have one white car in their household.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. So obviously the defense will say, hey, wait a minute, there's 100,000 white cars in that area. So just because you found a white car, there's just no evidence that that white car was Kohlberger's. That's my point. Let's go back to the other fact the guy said. So we got, go back to the facts again. He bought a knife. There was a sheath. There was a white car. Kohlberg drives a white car. And the fourth one, according to the phone analysis, Kohlberger came back to the building according to their phone records. We don't know how long. We don't know what time. We don't know how they got that information. But those are the four things that the Fox detective said, this is a locked case. Now, I don't know much about criminal trials, and I don't know much about forensics per se, but I know a lot about logic. The white car is not going to fly very much because, as you said, there's a lot of white cars. Secondly, the sheath is probably pretty damaging, but it doesn't mean that it was only, doesn't mean that Kohlberger was the only person, the only killer. Now, the defense hired an expert. I'll get his name in a second. This guy's already filed a report, and he's going to be allowed to testify in trial, as I understand it. And he already says, hey, it had to be done by two people. And his theory was that the place looked cleaned up, whatever that means, and that no one could clean it up that fast, whatever that means, except if there was two people. Now, maybe the survivors were in on it. Maybe they helped clean up the place.
Scandal.
But I'm just telling you, now I'm going to go over kind of like a timeline here. And this is a timeline that Fox News put out, and it's not complete. But it's, you know, it probably works for our report, right? 4 a.m., suspect arrives at house. No idea how they come up with this. But between 4 and 4:17 time of murders. Okay, again, that's some medical examiners.
Well, like his blood evidence, and they can do that from organs and stuff like
yeah,
that.
But whether or not they can do that, they're not even testing the bodies for 8 hours or 9 hours later. So my only point is, how can they pinpoint the death in 17 minutes? But they say they can. Fine. That's what they have, right? Factually speaking, that's what they reported. I would be questioning whether or not any medical examiner can do a time of death within 17 minutes. At 4:19, the roommate calls three victims. No one answers. First, why did she call the roommates? 2 minutes later, why? She just happened to be awake. Oh, my God, hang on, I'll call my roommates. 4:22 to 4:24, surviving roommates text each other from inside the house. 4:22 to for 2 minutes, the survivors are texting each other. Okay. 4:27, 5 minutes later, roommate calls victims again. No one answers. But again, survivors don't do anything. 4:32, roommate texts Concalvis, and she says, please answer. No answer. 10:23, now, 6 hours later, surviving roommate texts victims. No one answers. What happens between 4:30 and 10:23? Who knows? They weren't concerned enough to go to the other bedrooms? 11:39, roommate calls her father. That's new, by the way. In all the timelines I've seen, I've never seen that call take place. At 12 p.m., 9/11 call placed from roommate's phone. Now, as I understand it, we don't know yet who placed that call. We do know it was from one of the surviving roommate's phone, apparently, but we don't know who made it. Was it BT or DM? We don't know, right? Now, listen to some other things and just think about this from a common sense standpoint. So at 4:32, as I mentioned, roommate text Concalvis, ask her to answer. Okay, so I guess this roommate, who got in, by the way, at 1:30 and was still, you know, probably hanging out with her friend, was awake. He got home at 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, between 5 a.m. and 6:30, DM, that's a survivor, engaged activity on her phone, primarily creating, editing, and deleting names and videos, the filing stated. Her phone activity ended at 8:05. So, listen to that. From 5 o'clock a.m. and 6:30 a.m. to 8:05 a.m., one of the survivors was on her phone deleting images and videos. On top of that, there's later talks about how she was doing Instagram.
Was she, did they know what type of videos and photos?
I don't know that. That's not in the court filing.
From the night before, it might have pictures of people they associated
with.
Yeah,
and I think that's a legitimate question, but isn't a bigger question? She's up at 5 o'clock. She doesn't check on her other roommates, and now she's busy working on her phone? She's working on her phone. I mean, this woman only must have had like 2.5 hours sleep. And now she's on her phone from 5 o'clock until 8 o'clock, and then nothing happens until 10:30, where now she decides, hey, I better text my friends again. So she texts Mogan, got no response. She then went on Instagram, she being DM, the survivor. She went on Instagram until 11:29. So from 10:23 a.m., DM, a survivor, was on Instagram for an hour and 6 minutes and never once checked on her friends.
Well, this you know, you're raising points that probably literally 99% of Americans aren't paying attention right now, but when they do, we need to reference them back to this banter. Folks, you're listening to Banter with Bob and Dan. We have special case moments. You know, we have a lot of different things on Banter, but you're going to hearken back to this on the 26th of April, because probably, what do you think, in the falls when this will go to court?
I would be very pessimistic about it going to court because there's so many rulings that have to be made yet. And remember, each side makes motions. Judge has to rule. I believe the current goal is trial will be in August of this year.
August, okay.
But you can imagine the defense is going to say, we haven't had enough time to prepare. We got what I'm reading now is new information. This is a recent court filing. This was filed Thursday night.
Well, wouldn't you like to have a private, I know they can't comment on it, but with the detectives or the investigators or the prosecuting attorneys, because as they're asking, you know, we have to put our minds into, you know, three floors, six people, college age. Sometimes they just, and of course, there's somebody's mom, brother, sister, grandchild, or whatever that was murdered, so we want to be respectful, but sometimes they may think, well, they had a boyfriend or a girlfriend or or that somebody was over, and we don't know that anything about their character, but they may just think, well, we don't want to bother them, and that's why DM just sure. was texting, not going up and knocking, because she didn't want to disturb perhaps a normal night of hanging out together.
Well, those are all, let's face it, possible answers, but we don't know what the facts are. We don't know why she didn't contact anybody. Remember, she said in the court filing that she saw one of her roommates on the floor. Now, if that roommate was on the second floor or the third floor, then DM would have had to get out of her bedroom, walk up a flight, see one of the roommates on the floor and say, I'll just let her sleep on the floor if she's drunk. Yeah. No, actually, that's totally different than how girls operate. They, you know, they're interested in what the other person, how's you doing, right? Now, remember, this girl being DM, one of the survivors, says, I was frantically texting the other survivor, frantically. Now, 4 hours later, what is she doing? She's working on her own phone, deleting photos and images, who knows why, and then she's on Instagram for an hour. No, there's certainly possible reasons why, but we're a long way from getting to the bottom of it. And that's the whole point of this banter, this segment. The reason I picked this murder to follow on Banter with Bob and Dan is because this is not going away.
You are enjoying Banter with Bob and Dan. Sometimes it seems like they might require protective spacesuits to work together. Likewise, some families don't always feel like they're in a beautiful field walking, holding hands off into the sunset. They don't have protection and help they'd like. Across America, there are families who face not only banter, but genuine hurtful moments that impact marriages and children. Blended families, step families, and even single parents every single day face very challenging dynamics and relationships. USABFA is an organization founded to offer understanding, encouragement, daily tips, resources, and services. If you're a single parent or in a blended family, check out USABFA.com. That's USABFA.com.
This is going to be bigger. You know, the OJ trial... Everybody remembers that trial, right? The attorneys that were involved. It was a big trial. And of course, OJ was released, but then eventually went to jail on a civil suit. This is going to be bigger than this, because first there was four people that were killed. Now they were knifed. And the OJ Simpson trial, wasn't that a knife?
Yeah.
Yeah. These people were knifed. Nobody heard them. And couple more things, and I'm just raising issues now. So the prosecution has hired digital specialists, and their names, we're going to hear them a lot. These people are going to make a ton of money on this case. Heather and Gerard Barnhart, digital specialists retained by law enforcement to analyze Kohlberger's cell phone and PC. Now, according to this, they didn't analyze anybody else's phone. They analyzed his phone and his PC, and they determined that there were abnormal gaps.
And his phone, they did say, now, they say his phone was in the vicinity, because unless he had his GPS and did something, it'd just be between cell tower locations.
Yeah, they did say somewhere that his phone was pinged and he was somewhere in the vicinity. That's one of the facts that the Fox detective brought up, right? Okay, now, but that's not enough to say he killed him. It's right. enough to get him off the, because again, remember, in a criminal trial, we have to have a preponderance of evidence, not a majority of evidence, a preponderance of evidence for conviction. In a civil trial, we just need, where they say, greater than 50% chance that he had some responsibility for the murders. But even in the civil trial, they don't say he's guilty.
Important, you'd mentioned it previously, I think, on a banter or to me. But he is the alleged is a criminal justice student trying to get a PhD in criminal justice. So he really understands the study of crime, of forensics, of, you know, how to commit.
Yeah. And how detectives work, how forensics work.
Yeah.
Now, he was getting his PhD from Washington State University. These students were at the University of Idaho. But apparently it's pretty close. Apparently, University of Idaho is on the border between Idaho and Washington State.
I can't remember. What was he? How did he know? Did he know these students in any way? Was there any connection?
That's not clear yet, right? It's not clear if he knew them or didn't know them, right? Now, there may be some allegations about that, but so far, not much. But here's kind of what the points are. First, the defense has hired a guy named Brent Turley, T-U-R-Y-E-Y, Turvey. He's a crime scene analyst. And he said that there were attempts by the suspects, remember that plural, are you with me?
Yeah, more than one.
Attempts by the suspects to clean up the crime scene after the homicide, which he claims would have taken far longer than the time interval alleged by the state. I don't know what time interval the state alleged, but in any event, he's already making the point that no one person couldn't have done this, right?
Yeah. This is intriguing stuff, Bob.
Pardon me?
This is intriguing stuff.
The judge, his name, by the way, is Stephen Hippler. And he ruled that Barnhart's testimony, that's the prosecution's forensic analysis, is admissible, right? As well as the 9/11 call placed by the roommates. See, it's again, there was no 9/11 call placed by the roommates. There was a 9/11 call placed by a roommate on a phone for which we don't know who owned that phone, right?
So I don't understand that. I mean, the number would come across in 911, depending on what software they have.
Yeah, they can identify the phone. They don't know who owned the phone. At least it's not been disclosed yet.
Yeah.
In other words, they know, they obviously, I guess they know the phone number that's targeted from. They haven't figured out who owned that phone, which sounds kind of really basic to me. But see, there's a lot of basic things that you would think would have already been.
Things we don't know. And that's what makes for great television, great radio, great podcasts, right, as we keep them on the edge of their seat, Bob, as we have to kind of wind down here. So if you got any closing comments here, as we wind down, anything to just keep people wanting to come back for the special edition Idaho Murders. They'll see it on YouTube. They'll see it in the title, Special Edition Idaho Murders. Any
exactly
closing thoughts?
Now, when you say wind down, what does that mean?
It means we got like 3 or 4 minutes here before our...
Got it. Now that I can deal with, right? So keep this in mind, listeners. First, we've got two timelines. We're going to have three timelines before we're finished. We're going to have the timeline that Fox News produced, which is probably accurate, but it's incomplete because it doesn't include what? It doesn't include the time they heard the dog barking. It doesn't include the call to DoorDash to deliver food. The 2 points on that is apparently somebody heard, we don't know who, we don't know what the report is, a dog barking at 4:17. I don't know whether the dog was inside the house, outside the house. It's so obvious that I wonder it's not in everybody's timeline, but it's not. It's in a timeline that I have that's prepared by someone else. Now, so one timeline is the Fox News timeline. Then we have the timeline prepared by, well, I think it's NBC, but it could be CNN. Now, I'm going to prepare my own timeline, and that's going to be very detailed. So it won't be
the
different.
The Sherwood timeline.
Yeah.
The Sherwood.
It won't be different than the timelines. It'll be more complete.
Yeah.
Right? So, for example, to be specific, so they've got a 4:19 roommate calls three victims, no one answers. Well, according to what I understand, at 4:17, someone, who knows who, heard a dog barking. So I'm going to add that to their timeline. At 4 a.m., suspect arrives at house. Well, according to the other court filings, DoorDash delivered food at 4 a.m.
This is hot stuff. This is why this should be the the short, the YouTube short for why people should listen to this podcast, because we've got the Fox News timeline, the with an other news agency timeline, and the Sherwood more detailed. Yeah, listen for the banter with Bob Sherwood and Dan Snell on the Sherwood timeline of the Idaho murders.
We're going to publish on our, I don't know where we're going to put it, our own official timeline, which will be a summary. It'll be a summary of, just a second here. Let me get back. We're going to publish our own timeline somewhere. I don't know where. It'll be not our opinion of the timeline, but it'll be a factual combination of the timelines reported by the different news agencies and eventually by the defense or the prosecution.
Well, we'll just embed it in our video. We'll share screen. We'll put the PDF right up there on the screen.
Good point.
You and I will be tiny. And the Sherwood timeline.
Yeah. And
be big on the screen.
And so we're going to be bringing this, the latest news on this to you. On our normal banter, we'll do it for 2 or 3 minutes. But if we have big news, occasionally we do a whole banter just on this Brian Kohberger issue, because listen in, listeners, the O.J. Simpson trial, that was huge. Eventually, it was on TV. People watched it. Remember, one of the attorney's daughters became very famous after that trial. Who was that?
The attorney.
The Kardashians.
Yeah, the attorney. Yeah.
The attorney. So what I'm saying is the attorneys became famous. So this is going to be the same thing. And the defense, now the criminal trial, the prosecution just blew it. Now, hardly anybody even remembers the names of the two people that were prosecuting the O.J. Simpson, because they went into Never Never Land. They lost so badly. But most people remember the names of the attorneys on the defense team and what the defense won with, right? If it fits or if it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Yeah, that's right, the famous lines.
Right. Now, this is going to be just like that, maybe bigger, right?
It will be big. That's why people want it.
It's going to be big, and the court still hasn't ruled on a key point that I brought up. And if we're at the end, let me know. A key point was that the prosecution wants to bring the parents in and testify. The defense wants the parents to be in the courtroom. That's conflicting, because people who testify can't be in the courtroom to hear other people to testify. So the judge has said, I think it's a pretty straightforward thing. He said to the prosecution and the defense, we'll bring the parents in first. Before anybody else testifies, they can testify. Then they can sit in the room while everybody else testifies. Now, the prosecution is going to object to this 100%, because they want to bring the parents in when it suits their procedure, right?
Right. Yeah, that'll be interesting.
But if they don't agree to that, then the judge has a problem, because the parents can't sit there. Now, the judge could also say, well, they can sit there when nobody's testifying. Well, people are testifying all the time. And apparently, now this is part of the law, I'm not totally familiar with that, apparently the defense in this case has the right to have the parents or close relatives in the room for emotional support. So all I'm driving at on this whole idea of when the trial is, there's going to be motion after motion after motion by the defense, by the prosecution. What can be admitted? What can't be admitted? There's going to be testimony at trial that's going to be, I can't use the word exciting. That's not true, because it's not respectful of these people that got murdered. But what's on trial, what we're really looking at here is how our system of justice works. And remember, these people were murdered over 2 years ago. There's been no trial yet.
No
they
trial.
Were in November
and the house has been torn down. I had not heard that.
The houses was torn down. Apparently, the prosecution, I think, and maybe the defense too, said, hey, don't tear it down. The university, for some reason, just brought a bulldozer in, tore it down. And now they've hired somebody who will probably charge $500,000 to recreate the house. I mean, this is a huge amount of money.
Was it a house or an apartment complex?
Well, I don't know. Let's call it a building. Let's call it right now a three-story building. We could call it an apartment complex if you like. All I know is it's three stories. There were two bedrooms on each floor. And if I look at the picture, it looks like you walk in a door, and it looks like that's the first floor.
Yeah.
So now,
but we will continue to learn this as we continue.
Think about questions. Think about things you want me to look at. Audience, listen to this. If you think about a question, ask it by email.
Webtalkwithbob@gmail. Webtalkwithbob@gmail.
Grandparents often stand on the sidelines, watching their son or daughter's news-to-family navigate challenges, feeling unsure of how to help. But what if you could offer them a gift that brings confidence, support, and understanding? Welcome to USABFA, the National Association for Blended Families and Single Parents. Grandparents like Jeff and Becky made the choice to gift a USABFA membership, and they saw the difference it made. It became the best decision for their family's future. For less than $4 a month, USABFA provides daily and weekly resources tailored to step family dynamics, on-demand videos, podcasts, and coaching tips, exclusive savings on products and services. This is more than a membership. It's a lifeline. It's a gift that equips your family with the tools and support to thrive together. Join the largest family demographic in America. Turn challenges into milestones and be part of the solution. With USABFA, you're never alone on this journey.
If you disagree with something with one of my facts, let me know. Maybe I've got it incorrect. I'm trying to be factual. I'm not for the defense. I'm not for the prosecution. I don't know if he's guilty or not. Obviously, who knows that? Maybe he knows, but he might be the only one, right? So, but we're going to keep everybody informed on this because this will be one of the most exciting. That's not the right term. It'll be the
epic,
biggest trial since O.J. Simpson.
Iconic. Epic.
It'll be epic, right? And it'll go on for, I don't know, probably 10 years, because if he is found not guilty, not innocent, but found not guilty, the parents will definitely have a civil suit against him. There'll be enough damaging circumstantial evidence to at least make him seem liable. Remember, keep in mind, civil trials and criminal trials are different. And just like the O.J. Simpson case, if you're found not guilty in a criminal trial, it doesn't mean the jury found you innocent.
Right.
It just determined that there was not enough evidence to find you guilty.
So about every 2 weeks, we'll do an update on this special banter case?
Yeah, well, I'm going to try to get copies of all the filed motions.
Oh, wow.
So I don't have to read somebody else's summary, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
because, and by the way, this is going to be a massive AI application. Massive. All of the filed motions are going to be aggregated, you know it, into a single file so that it can be searched easily.
Huh.
It's going to be a massive AI, and they'll be using AI at trial.
Yeah,
to
there's
demonstrate certain things and show certain things. It's going to be huge. Now, one thing I wonder about is that the prosecution is being paid by the taxpayer and the defense is being paid by the taxpayer.
Ooh.
So the taxpayers have quite a bit invested in this trial.
So, yeah. Now, what happens? Who pays that? I would imagine origination Moscow, not Boise. Yeah,
well,
the state
of Idaho is the plaintiff.
Okay.
So they're filing the lawsuit against a defendant. The state is the plaintiff. They're complaining. Okay. The parents aren't filing a lawsuit. They can only file in civil court.
Yeah.
Now, if I can, I have a very close relative who is a district attorney who deals with murder trials routinely. And if I can, if he can do it without sacrificing his own integrity and his own work, I'm going to get him on eventually and ask him to explain some of the legalities of this.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be
dozens and dozens of murder trials. He has dozens of attorneys work for him, but I don't know if he can do it without bringing some liability on.
Or something he said previously in a similar situation.
I'm going to ask him later this week if he could come on. Not right away, maybe in 2 or 3 months, maybe.
Yeah. So, folks, you got to stay tuned. Special edition Idaho College murder case. Bob Sherwood has the Sherwood timeline, which exceeds and excels over any of the other timelines out there.
We're going to be focused on a couple of things. First, we're going to have a criminal attorney on our show when the trial's going on that we can ask to explain what's going on. We're not going to rely on Fox's attorney or the prosecution attorney or the defense attorney. We're going to have our own. Secondly, we're going to spend quite a bit of time focusing on the expert reports, the digital reports, the forensic report, and also the report which says, hey, there had to be two people here. Those reports are going to be critical.
So can they, not to continue this on, but for the next time, can they find guilty one person even though they know there was a second person?
I don't know.
That's
right now. There's no second person that's a plaintiff or a defendant. They would have to have another, accusation or something come up, because right now there's only a single defendant. That's Brian Kohlberger, and there's the prosecution, which is the state.
Right. Well, we'll continue on.
Stay tuned. This is another reason to listen to Banter, because we do these three things. We do banter, we do special segments like Ryan Kohlberger, and we do conversations with interesting people.
You got it all right here, Banter.
There you go.
Watch it.
Podcast audio listeners can find this video on YouTube. Search Banter with Bob and Dan.